Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And we're delighted today to be joined by Mark Diacono, the food writer, grower and photographer, who is the founder of Otter Farm in East Devon. The author of 7 books, his latest, Sour, the Magical Element That Will Transform Your Cooking, is out now. Mark, welcome to our podcast.
Very happy to be here, thank you.
So, we always start at the beginning with childhood. What are your earliest memories of food and cooking?
It was mixed, I think it's fair. From when I was about 10, I was with my dad. He had more of a sort of short rota rather than a repertoire when it came to the kitchen. But even by that age, I was very drawn to confectionery. And it's really difficult for me to sort of try and encourage my daughter to eat well when she can really happily just say, but you spent all your dinner money on sweets. And I did. And a lot of them were, looking back at it, were the sours, you know, the acid drops and the sherbet lemons and all of that. Apart from that, I guess I remember my mum's cheese and onion pie for some reason. But apart from that, very hazy. You know, I certainly wasn't one of those kids who was kind of brought up on someone's knee, endlessly stirring the cake, and fell in love with all things food. It kind of came very much later on in life.
So jumping forward a bit, did it come from the gardening and the growing, or did you start gardening because you love food? Which came first?
It was definitely the food. It was the revelation, I think, that there were things that I couldn't eat unless I grew them myself. One of the turning points of my life, unquestionably, was the first mulberry I ever ate. And I was working in Suffolk and staying with a friend, and she said, hey, the mulberries are, you know, the mulberry tree is ready. They're ripe tonight, you know, hey. And I'm like, yay? Is that a good thing? And I'd never tasted anything like it. It was a complete revelation to me. The flavour, you know, and why wasn't I eating this every year? Why wasn't I eating this all the time? Why hadn't I eaten it? And obviously there are certain things that just can't come to the market. They're too full of gorgeousness. When they're completely ripe, they'll fall to bits. And it just blew me away. And that was part of the... But that was the moment, you know, where I thought, I've got to have a little patch of land where I can grow some mulberries. And then other things followed. But, you know, it's definitely from being a greedy guts now. But I do love the grow inside as well, yeah.
And just going back slightly, what were meals like when you were younger? Did you sit down at the table and...
Yeah, but, you know, it was interesting because it was my dad and I, and we had a very good battle through most of my teens. So mealtimes were really things to kind of get out of the way. Interestingly, he was from Sri Lanka, and as you can see, I have nothing that would indicate that I'm from anywhere apart from the West Country. So, he liked everything hot. Hot, hot, hot. So there was curry 3-4 times a week, and it was, you know, pokey. So I've kind of come back to the love. You know, like a lot of people, you reject everything that's yours at that age. But I've definitely come back to that kind of thing.
So was he cooking these curries?
He was.
What kind of curries were they?
Just hot. There was no a dead thing, well curried, and very heavily chilied. There was little finesse and everything by way of, you know, dynamite. And it's interesting because, you know, the what you think is normal. I mean, he was odd. And it's, you know, again, it's peculiar. If you've got, you know, a parent who's a bit peculiar, you don't realise that everybody else isn't, you know, that, and that everybody, you know. So and I think I mentioned in the book, you know, there are things that he would only allow in the house at Christmas. Random, non-Christmassy things, you know, after eights, piccalilli, ginger ale. You know, you would never see them. They just weren't in the house. But at Christmas, it was like, all this stuff's coming to town. And you'd go, hey, Dad, we could get some piccalilli. It's like, it's June, don't be silly. you know, really, like, crazy. So, yeah, I think part of falling more deeply and widely in love with food and cooking side has been, I'm kind of interested in, I think, how people are peculiar about food. And we all are in our odd ways. And definitely some of that has come from realising how odd my old man was. And that dread that we're supposed to all head that way, aren't we? of our parent. Let's hope not.
And were you adventurous as Anita as a child? I mean, you obviously now enjoy picking out the peculiar and the unusual. Yeah. Has that always been the case?
No. Much later. I'm quite late on everything. You know, I went to university late. I do everything later than a sensible person. No, I remember pretty clearly even the idea of foraging, or, you know, as in eating mushrooms, you know, it wasn't going to happen. You know, it was, if this stuff was good, it would be in the shops. Don't be silly. And I buy it in the shops, you know. And I definitely remember that. I was really not particularly adventurous. And I think maybe that's maybe some of the comfort that comes from having food that repeats very often, mm-hmm. is that you don't go anywhere else with it. It's not, there's no surprise. But the upside of that is that it's a whole world to discover when the light finally switches on. You know? So I definitely wasn't particularly adventurous, but like I say, I think that's not a terrible thing anyway.
There was a line that made me laugh in your book, which was that you said, I'm not sure which came first, losing my virginity or my first real lemon. And then you say that you have no recollection of citrus being available until the early 80s. I mean, do you think we now take it for granted that, you know, lemons are sort of available everywhere?
It's totally that. It's still my favourite definition of middle class is there's fruit in the house and no one's ill. I remember really clearly a friend at school walking out of the greengrocer's with a bag of satsumas. And if he'd have come out with a koala, I'd have been less surprised. You know, it was like, what are you doing? You know, I was like, what are they? Yeah, and it genuinely feels like that. You know, if there was a grapefruit, it was covered in, you know, a very dense duvet of sugar. You know, it really felt like, I don't know, like when pesto came. You know, when rocket hit, you know, our shores, it was like, the world changed. You know, it's like, whoa, we're actually continental. And that's how it felt with this. I just don't remember them being around at all. And like I say, as I was saying, with the love of flavours when I was a kid, the sour stuff that I loved was most of it was kind of false sour. You know, it was sherbet lemons rather than lemons. It was acid drops. It was salt and vinegar crisps. You know, it wasn't the original sauce, and that even went down to the kind of Jif lemon rather than the real lemon. Yeah, you know, if I see a lemon, there's a bit of my head just going, "This is pancake day," you know, because that's the only time they were there. It wasn't them; it was a plastic one. Yeah.
Looking at growing, moving on from your childhood, yeah. How did you end up in gardening?
Happy accident. You know, I'm not. I really try hard to plan things, and I'm really not good at it. Most men who don't know what they're doing tend to throw themselves at stuff in too large a way in the hope that something sticks. Mm-hmm. And that's very much what I did. So when I met Candida, who's my wife, when I met her, I was deeply attractive to her because I had a garden and she didn't. But then nothing happened in this garden. And then she came and kind of took it over and generally did some good things to it. And I realised very quickly that I had to do something out there other than listen to the football results. Otherwise, I'd never see her. So, yes, I took the radio outside, but I thought, what does a bloke do in the garden? He grows buds. So I did. And that was, you know, simple. Put them in the ground, look at them once in a while, harvest them, and you're a caveman, you know, who's done great things. And it kind of rolled on from there. And I think actually that was quite a window into things because the first lot of potatoes were extraordinary, you know, early, nutty, small salad, phenomenal flavour, totally different to what you could buy in the shops. And then the next stuff that came through was like bigger main crop. It could be bought or it could be, you know, and that really kind of woke me up to the difference between about varieties and like, you know, what a real difference it is to be more inquisitive about what you're growing, because it takes no more effort to grow the best pea in the world, the best potato, than it does the worst. But there was a little germ that went off. And then when we moved down to Devon, it was she and I took a rotavator to about 2 acres, like a twit. you know, just throw yourself at it, Diacono, and something might work. And just sowed a load of stuff and spent the next 6 or 7 months fighting the encroachment of everything that wants to go on to 2 acres. And took, you know, 18 skipfuls of everything into the house and then went, what the hell are we going to do with this? I just didn't think it through at all, but I was all enthusiasm and absolutely no idea. But that's not the worst way sometimes.
You know? No, seems to have worked out quite well.
You find your way, and I think a lot of it is, it's just that, but I really quickly figured out that I wasn't growing volume, I was growing flavour. That's what I needed to do. It was all about, I wanted to grow extraordinary food, because you look at what most people grow on an allotment, it's, you know, it's the cheapest, most widely available, most disease-prone food you can think of. And then the rest, of you carry on buying the expensive stuff. It's just bonkers. And there seems so much out there that we can be growing and enjoying that's completely different, unbuyable, delicious, so much better if you grow it yourself, all of that stuff. So that's what I did.
What sorts of things would you say are the things to be grown?
Oh, the things to be grown, I think grow flavour rather than volume. So don't, I tend not to grow main crop anything, so no main crops, buds, carrots, anything like that, because they're the cheap end of the shop. I grow lots of herbs. I grow Sichuan pepper. I grow, you know, all of these things take your regular stuff off in all kinds of different directions. And they're very, very easy to grow. I grow a lot of perennials because it takes a lot of effort and energy to grow all the annual stuff. So I've got a lot of fruit, a lot of spices, a lot of herbs. And there are a whole load of things that I knew I wanted to try just for the fun of it that maybe people hadn't grown here before. You know, it's bonkers that we all have pepper in the house and maybe 18 of us grow pepper in the country.
Can you grow pepper?
You can't grow black pepper because it's tropical, but you can grow Sichuan pepper, Nepalese pepper, Japanese pepper, you know, and they're £5 a little packet, and you can eat the leaves as well as the pepper. It's just phenomenal. Really, pop one in the ground. I've run one over in a tractor and it's come back. You can be absolutely incompetent and they will give you amazing things. And it's like I say, mulberries and quince and, you know, a lot of forgotten things that used to be really popular that I wanted to set about growing too. So that's it. I just wanted to grow stuff where if it worked, you go, yes, amazing, rather than go, shit, I've got 2 tons of courgettes.
And I don't like courgettes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely that.
What do you think about courgettes? Because lots of people obviously do grow them, but then there always seems to be this period in the summer where everyone goes, I've got so many courgettes, yeah. I need to get rid
yeah.
of them.
No, I've got some very definite ideas about courgettes, right? The thing is, what you have to do is make a friend of your compost bin. And the first thing to think of is 6 inches is the biggest courgette you ever eat, right? You pick them that size all the time. You've got to think, what's the plant trying to do? It's not trying to feed you, it's trying to reproduce, right? So you pick them every day that big. If you can't use it, in the compost. Can't use it, in the compost. It doesn't matter. You're not eating all the leaves as well. Mm-hmm. You're quite happy to compost some of the plant. So just think about that. If you let it get bigger, what's it doing? The seed's maturing, it's starting to slow down, stops producing, and you get no flavour out of it. That's the size. So you just pick them that size. If you can't use it, in the compost. It's really, really important. Then you keep the plant vibrant and young and lively. You get courgettes when you want. You don't get these enormous things that are absolutely, what are they? They're just vessels for interestingly spiced meat.
Like such a liberating way to grow and
it's
garden.
Totally that. It's like, why would you, what, you want to walk around town going, do you have some courgettes? Piss off, I've got them more from the person next door. It's not the way to go. I think that's all you have. It's a food machine, you know? It's a food machine. It's not giving you one thing like a cauliflower is. It's giving you endless stuff. Still, you don't buy from the shop just because it offers it you all the time. You just go, no thank you. No thank you, into the compost. That is really important. Always pick them small.
What are you proudest of growing?
Oh, there's a good thing. Maybe the Sichuan pepper, because I think if I'm synonymous with a plant and kind of popularising it, it would be Sichuan pepper. So maybe that, maybe the mulberry, because I've quacked on about the mulberry for years. Maybe, do you mean proudest as in like, yeah, I got that to grow. Yeah. Okay. I've planted a pecan orchard.
Wow.
A pecan orchard. And that was lovely because it was, again, it was accidental. A friend who used to work with me in the vineyard, he's American, went back to the States, and I was talking to my daughter, who then was maybe 6, and she had a globe, but we just bought her. I was going, look, Trent's here now. And I did that, and that's where we are. And I kind of spanned the globe with my finger and went, hey, it's kind of not a wildly different latitude here. And I'd just been reading about pecans having reached Canada, because they come from the southern states of America. And what happened is some idiot, every time they'd done all right in one place, would take the best seedlings that had come up and move them up. You know, somebody had grown 10 miles north, eventually get to Canada. Mm. So I ordered 40 young seedlings from Canada and planted them, and they just stayed the same size for about 4 years. I'm looking at them going, you little buggers. I got you over here, you know. I planted you by the Mississippi, i.e. the otter. You know, come on. And they just spend all the time putting the roots down, big fat root. And then they suddenly went boom. And I was strimming under them one year, and it was hot. And I sat down, and I kind of leant against the trunk of this tree. And I thought, shit, maybe, it's kind of odd. I might be the first person who's leant against a pecan tree in his orchard in the UK ever. How weird is that? That's kind of, but owed totally to all of these other people who had incrementally moved it north. And that's one of the things I love about growing and food, essentially, is you feel so connected to other interesting people, other interesting cultures. It's a kind of never-ending exploration, you know. Mm. It wasn't that thing of, hey, look what I've... there was just that feeling of, shit, it's an odd moment to be in a pecan orchard. Very, very slow to produce. You're not going to get full on pecans. Such a lovely plant as well. Yeah. So, yeah, maybe that was a good one to
That's
do.
A pretty cool answer.
It's not bad. It's not bad.
And how did you end up going from your kind of more sort of amateur gardening to being head gardener at River Cottage?
It was a bit random. I'm living in Kent with my wife, who in the garden that she finds me deeply attractive because of. First series of River Cottage comes on, and my work then was, I used to advise government agencies and so on about managing the landscape, but on kind of on a national and international level. And I thought, there's a book here I want to write about eating the landscape, you know, about how what we see is essentially how we eat out there, all that stuff. And I was watching the first series of River Cottage, and back in the day when people used to write to each other, I wrote Hugh a letter, said, we ought to write a book. This kind of eat the view thing, you know, you do the food, I'll do the landscape, mm-hmm. you know, H. Fernley Whittingstall, River Cottage, Dorset. And then we moved to Devon a couple of months later, rings me up, can't do the book, because I'm writing the first River Cottage one, let's go on fishing. So I went out fishing, and I kind of got a bit involved accidentally, you know, again. And then the guy who was the head gardener left, and they asked me to do it, and I said, I can't, I'm doing my other stuff. And then this other guy left, and they said, can you do the courses? And I'm like, I can do the courses, that's fine. So I got kind of involved. It was a bit odd to be calling me the head gardener, really, because I kind of set the scene for the team who really did everything, because I knew that I could make it interesting, but also have that kind of view that would link up with courses and also with the kitchen really well. But they did all the kind of skilled stuff, you know. So, yeah, again, it was just random luck, but fun. And, you know, the early days of River Cottage were a good time, because I don't think it's pulling up any trees to say no one really knew what they were doing, and kind of found out while doing it, and lots of nice people involved, and many of them still there, you know. So, yeah, but that was fun. But I was always, you know, it wasn't like that's what I did and then I did Otter Farm, you know. It's that's what I did and I was already planting stuff that became this unusual place, you know.
Tell us about Otter Farm.
I wanted to move back towards East Devon, which is where I'm from. I knew I wanted to plant stuff, and we missed out on a house we were going for. We got married on the way back from our kind of wedding kind of gathering. We went to see this place that was a kind of old cider barn with 17 acres out the back, and my wife went into the house and I went out the back, and then we met at the end and went, did you like your bit? And went, yeah, it was quite nice, but a bit odd. And that was it. And then we moved in, and my wife was like, what's your plan? It's got 17 acres out there. And I said, mulberries? I don't know. There's two places I can think. One is in the bath, and one is on a train. So one day I'm looking forward to maybe the Orient Express. Bath on a train, and I'd write a really great...
pictures.
It'd be brilliant. But I went to the bath, and I was reading Jane Grigson's fruit book. And in going to mulberries, because I thought, I want to just imagine what I'm going to make, I went to Medlar's, and right next to each other, I was like, hang on, there are things here that this is the thing. Look at recipe books,
yeah,
and figure out what you want to grow, rather than look for gardening books and figure out what. That's exactly what I did. So I made a big list of all the stuff I liked, and gradually it wasn't a plan, it was like, what do you want to eat? Okay, I want to plant an orchard of that. Mulberries, Medlar's, quince have got to go in. There's got to be an orchard of apples, and that's how the first year was. Walnuts, yeah, I planted a load of walnuts in the wrong place and moved them the next year. But it really was like that. It was like, what do you want to eat? That, okay, where's a good place for it? That is. And then eventually you kind of go in, hang on a minute, there's an entity out there. It was very much like going, I've walked into a massive hotel, which is my bedroom, this one, because I'm in it, which is your office, the one next door. You know, and it was like that until you eventually go, no, I'm in a hotel, aren't I? I should think a little bit more strategically about this. So, yeah.
I mean, obviously, you've said before that you were interested in sour sweets, but when did you hit upon this idea of doing a book specifically about sourness?
It was really interesting because I had, like many people, started wrestling with making sourdough, and, you know, your first loaf's amazing, third, fourth, fifth, really crap. And then another one that's great, you know, it's like the classic golfing thing where, you know, you're brilliant enough just to keep you interested in crap the rest of the time. So I got interested in the whole thing of gut health a little from trying a few other bits and bobs of fermenting food. But then it all kind of rushed in together. It was really odd. You know, I met a couple of really lovely people, Gabby and Hans Whelan from Ireland, who I met when I was involved with an organisation called GIY in Ireland, Naomi Devlin, who's up the road in Bridport, and we were just, it was odd. It was like all the things I was getting interested again, like making sourdough, doing the fermenting, all of that kind of started to come together. And I'm still not sure which kicked off which, but it was that reawakening of the sourness love. And when you're growing a lot of things that are sour anyway, and I've got a quite sour palate compared to the next person, so is my daughter. You know, she's a real lemon sucker and a real kind of give me the peel off the Bramleys you're making a pie with. And my wife really isn't so much, but she's now makes the best kombucha out of anyone. So it was really just that coming together. But also I noticed that I was reading and using a lot about how to use sourness well without it being overly kind of presented as that. But Nick Sharma wrote really well about it in his last book, you know, and many, many other people about using different sours. And I was exploring different stuff and different spice mixes like chat and all that kind of stuff. It was just that coming together going, hang on, most of what I'm cooking, almost all of it has an element of sourness here. I come from a culture, we don't do fermented food in the same way that the rest of the world does. We're okay with fermented stuff as long as it gets us drunk or it's bread. The rest of it can go. Very suspicious of the rest of it. And we're not really into sour unless it's vinegar or lemon. And it just seemed like, hang on, there's, again, a parallel, I guess, with the growing stuff. There's a whole world of this stuff out there. You know, go to another culture in your brain, never mind physically, and you've got, you know, tamarind and amateur and endless different flavours and stuff. And there's a lovely way of using it. I was making a lot of cocktails. I was getting into cocktails too. And they are, you know, in lots of ways, alcoholic salad dressings where you're trying to balance up the sweet, the sharp, the aromatic stuff with punch and a bit of length to it as well. And it was just all the sort of coming together. And I'm dreadful at book proposals. Absolute torture to me. You know, I just want to go, can I just write the book I fancy and I'll give it at the end and you can call it what you want. Which you can't do, obviously.
Yeah, they're really weird about that.
They're really
funny.
They don't like it's it, like no. They want to get an idea whether it's going to sell and stuff, which is so crushing on your creativity. But I think I wrote this kind of proposal that was really hard work about all the kind of transforming skills. And then it kind of occurred that most of them were souring, you know, the sourdough, the kombuchering, the fermenting, all of that stuff. And it kind of got a life of its own from there, you know. And I'm totally not giving my editor any credit at all for her excellent role in kind of making me, you know, when you're going, it's kind of large and grey and it's got these big ears and a long nose. You know, it was so really, it's an elephant diacono, isn't it? It's like, yes, that's it. That was my idea. Yes, but yes.
And you've brought with you some sour. Are these all sour, these things that you
brought? They are. I didn't know if there was opportunity to.
Absolutely. There is opportunity. Right,
well, this is we'll invite you back. Yay. People who bring nice things get to come back.
Well, you might not agree that they're nice. Should we have a drink first? I would have brought my own kombucha, but being as I had to come up yesterday, it would have fizzed around like crazy. So this is a bought one, and do you know what? I've yet to try it. So are you familiar with kombucha and what it is, or should I explain anyway?
We might be, but just maybe explain to listeners.
It's not something that's going to make you go, yeah, I really fancy that. Essentially, it's fermented sweet tea. And what some fermented foods and drinks are fermented by encouraging or allowing wild bacteria to come streaming in. With kombucha, what you do is you actually add a community of bacteria, specific community of bacteria, or a community of specific bacteria. And they act in a certain way. They crunch through most of the sweet stuff. They leave some lactic acid behind, which is where we get the sourness from. There's a bit of carbon dioxide produced as well, which gives you a characteristic fizz. But the thing that you add looks like something you peel off a elephant's knee.
It's like just a jellyfish.
Oh, it's awful.
Is this the SCOBY?
That's the SCOBY, yeah. The symbiotic community of bacteria and yeasts. Go me. Remembering that.
I did not know that's why it was called what it was called.
Yeah, so there you go. And so this is the important. So essentially what you do is you slip this unpleasant jellyfish into your cooled sweet tea and you leave it in a big open top jar with muslin over the top so that bacteria. So air can get in, and that's crucial for the whole process. Leave it to ferment until it tastes of a degree of sourness that you like. Then you bottle it. There'll be a gentle fizz to it. You can also add other things. I tend to add raspberry and maybe star anise or something like that. And then you get something that's like really appealing cherryade. But it should be good like this anyway. I've not had this one, but this is an apple one, I think.
That's lovely.
So this is, just so people know what we're drinking, this is Willy's Sparkling Apple Kombucha and
ACV's
Apple Cider Vinegar, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got apple cider vinegar.
That's really nice.
Isn't that good?
Yeah.
And, you know, you wouldn't know that it's something as unappealing as fermented sweet tea with a jellyfish in. But
packaged what, so well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they do great vinegar, for sure. But I didn't know that they did kombucha, but I thought it was worth a try. And the sparkling there will be the carbon dioxide that's naturally released. You're not only getting a real lovely hit of kind of nutrient-wise, which you get with a lot of fermented foods, but you're ingesting some of the bacteria that are doing it, which is all of those things are wonderful for your own internal biome, your microbiome, which is crucial to not only digesting food well, getting more of the nutrient benefit out of it in the first place. So essentially this is feeding you twice. You know, the more studies are done, the more it becomes apparent that it's not just our physical kind of well-being that our gut health influences, but also our kind of mental well-being. And that's kind of a crucial thing, I think. So that's one of the things I do quite like about it all. Entirely unscientifically, I feel better if I'm eating and drinking a reasonable amount of fermented food. And I'm the last person, you know, who's going to happily jump on that bandwagon. I'm one of those idiot men who's way happier going, that's a load of stuff and nonsense, I'm not doing it. But it totally isn't, so, yeah.
Well, it's delicious.
It's good, isn't it?
It's really nice.
What's the sourest thing you've ever eaten?
There's a really, really good question. The cocktail, which I might throw together for you in a minute, should be eye-closingly sharp, for sure. Sometimes your kimchi can be quite... Although that is, you know, kimchi essentially is a very, it's like a very spicy sauerkraut in very simple terms. This one is not so wildly hot, but it's quite sour, but you know, but it's a funny thing. I think you can learn sour because we've unlearned it by falling in love with sweetness rather too heavily. And you can kind of head back to a happy place where you, yes, you enjoy the sweet stuff, but sourness becomes, it's a funny thing. You watch people, they do that recoil, but then they go back in again. And kids do it. They do lemon face back in. It's interesting because a lot of it seems related to health. You know, most sour things are health-giving, either because they're bringing you the, you know, the digestive benefits of something that's fermented as well as being delicious. But lemon juice, excuse me. Willie's, you make me burp. We could maybe cut that line, couldn't we? We could totally cut that line or not. You know, all the citrus brings you all the vitamin C stuff too. So in a roundabout, totally not getting their answer to your question, maybe the cocktail, maybe a really sharp kimchi.
So, Mark, we'll try the cocktail later, but I think you've got something else with you as well, haven't you?
So, kimchi, okay? Now, there are lots of kimchis out there. Everybody's kimchi is very different to everybody else's. So it
smells great.
It's, you know, real big deal in many Asian countries. National dish all over the place. Often you'll find that what you've got to decide is where you want your degree of funk. You know, my degree of funk stops before the shrimp paste. You know, there's something about the shrimp paste that makes me go, do you know what? I really want to be butch enough to like this, but it smells like a tram driver's glove. You know, it's really not where I want to go. So there's a bit of fish sauce in there, but there's, you know, as in your regular kind of fish sauce. But essentially, I've shredded up a load of Chinese cabbage. You make another sauce that's hot, spicy. In they go together, having salted the Chinese cabbage for a while. And they sit, they form this lovely kind of salty, briny, fermenting liquid into which this sits and ferments away merrily. And it gets sourer and sourer as the lactic acid's released, as the bacteria working away. And it's lively, I think, without being hot or not properly hot, and sharp without being wild. It's fairly sour. Would you like to try some?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You can't open that fantastic smell and then not let us try.
Go on.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And really where you stop that fermentation place, and the way to stop fermenting vegetables certainly is to get them in the fridge, because that slows down the whole pace of everything. that's exactly what. But you do it when it's at the level of sourness that you like.
Mm.
So is that too
that's,
sour? For
no,
you?
That's really. It's sourer than other kimchis I've had, but it's really nice. It's really, that's as you funny. Say, it's really lively.
It's lively, and there's something about it that makes you go, oh hello.
Yeah, it's invigorating.
Yes, and this is something I love about sourness is that it's you're in the room with it. You know, it's kind of. It perks you up. It gets you going. You know, whether it's a cocktail, whether it's the kombucha, whether it's this, you feel like yes.
Yeah, you can't feel sluggish around.
No,
that,
I mean I'm ready for whatever, and you know, and I mean that is 20 months old.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, and I thought I'd say that now rather than go. Oh, I'm just eating actually. No, you're fine. But you know, in
it tastes good for 20 months old.
Yeah. There's not many things that are 20 months old that taste that good. But it's such an easy, lovely, delicious, wonderful thing to make, and it makes me happy. And it does become this kind of character in the room, you know. Mm. And the lovely thing, everything isn't consistent because when you're not the only living creature in the recipe, it's going to be a relationship. But I love it. I absolutely love it. And you do, you know, there's something thrilling about sourness and sour foods that don't come with sweet ones. And hey, I love sweet stuff as too. But there's something energizing or thrilling or exciting or even shocking, you know, in the case of some things that I just find very appealing.
Mark, thank you so much for joining our podcast. And Mark's new book, Sour, The Magical Element That Will Transform Your Cooking, is available now in all good bookshops and on Amazon.
Thank you for joining us on The Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website.